Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Grateful, I actually forgot about this, but I was reminded shortly this evening, and I thought one thing I might reflect on is three refuges: Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I found it a useful reflection. Many different people reflect on these in different ways. For me, right now, I find it useful. And the Buddha, the primary reflection, or that primary, what it brings to mind is hope. And because I ordained and have come to this life, because for me, existence seemed quite meaningless, pointless. And the one thing that seems to give me hope is the possibility of something beyond nibbana, something, and the Buddha stands for that hope that there is something more meaningful. And the Buddha also brings to mind that when I think of the qualities of the person, when I was in Thailand, I got to know the sort of the head of the Ajahn International, or at least the Thai, and perhaps the international Ajahn Chah Sangha, Lungpor Liam, or at least I met him. And there's this quality when I was sitting at a tent in Thailand, and he's sort of just so equanimous, and he's handing out bottles of his probiotic solution. And the one thing I really valued about sitting there as he hands out his little magic, or not, yeah, his little medicine, is this feeling of safety, and this feeling that this is somebody who I'm confident doesn't want anything from me, or really from anyone. And he's just that security that the Buddha had of just having reached true safety. And so that's the hope and the possibility that the Buddha represents. As for the Dhamma, that's the way to get there. And one of the helpful teachings that I've found is that no matter where we are, or there's always something we can be doing, and that even if we're not able to sort of let go or meet the whatever ideals that we maybe should feel we can do, we should uphold to, there's always something we can do, some aspect of the teaching we can be working on, even if we're not at the moment able to do a full-scale frontal assault on nibbana. And for example, something I find uplifting is that it seems like in any situation, if you think about it, there's always a way you can be generous, and it can be sort of, if there's only a little bit of something, you can say, well, you know, I'll let somebody else have my share, or I'll take less than what would be my share, or maybe you really want to say something, but it's an act of generosity just to say, okay, you know, I think this is actually, even though I really want to say it, I think it's an act of generosity to give other people the gift of keeping my mouth shut. So, And then finally, Sangha is, I'd say, people like Lungpur Liam, Ajahn Liam in Thailand, and people I met who seem to have this, that one aspect is people who seem to have this aspect of well-being and happiness, and that I, it seems like they've got something, and it gives me hope that it is possible to reach that goal, to free the heart or cultivate a deep well-being. And then Sangha also is points to the aspect of community and something we can give ourselves to, and something greater than ourselves. So I offer these thoughts for your reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangkhang namassami. It's interesting, I was reflecting during the sit about giving this talk, and I remember Ajahn Santo had mentioned a couple of years ago how he said, yeah, it's really hard to not think about what you're going to say, and just keep bringing the mind back. And I said, well, I'll just speak from the heart, and just try to speak from the heart, it's all that matters. And doesn't really matter what you say. And of course my heart's beating really quickly right now, so I'm not sure I really want to do that. But yeah, there can be coming to this practice, I think that it was really what inspired me so much was the possibility of peace, of the mind being peaceful. That there was something sort of transcendent to the everyday, just thinking and being, becoming and not being, and sort of a constant search for getting what I want. And there was just this, sometimes these pauses or these gaps, some a little bit longer, others just very short, where that wasn't the case. There was something else that was there. And the more I reflect on it, even in, you know, these past 2 weeks, it's just this underlying sense of discontent, really, this sense of just things not being how I want them to be, and in any given moment, that's just pervasive. I find it that the, you know, whether it's something about my body that's not right, something about some other person's body that's not right, somebody's speech, or whatever it is, it's always this kind of sense that just if it could just be some other way, then I would be happy. And I think that sort of recognizing it and kind of dwelling in these kind of pauses or these times when there's just a moment of seeing it more clearly can really help inspire the mind to see that there's a way out of that. And it was quite a mystery to me, like what it is. It still is a mystery, what it is to really be content. I think it's easy for me to think, well, I need to be content in this situation, and you know, how do I do that? How does somebody like Mampur, how is he content? He seems content a lot of the time. I wonder what. Okay, I got to be content, and you know, and there it is again. It's just this. I have to be, I should be, I must be, and. You know, I got to get my contentment, and so it's so easy to be tricked by that, to really sort of just kind of chase after you know, this ball that's not really there. It's kind of like I was reflecting on, like, there's this golden retriever. You know, you think of golden retrievers. I don't know how many of you know dogs, but they're really happy and they're easily excitable, and they're just kind of like, you know, they're a ball of metta a lot of the time, and you can kind of, you know, just do whatever you want with them, and they seem to be pretty happy, and they'll get into anybody's car, and you just open the door and they step in, and they, you know, they'll eat any kind of food that's offered to them, and, you know. And they're very sweet animals. You can throw a ball to them, and they'll just, you know, they run after it, bring it back, and you throw the ball. And then sometimes you don't throw the ball, but you pretend you throw the ball, and they're like, where'd it go? And they really believe the ball has been thrown. There's so much trust in this ball, and I think it's a good metaphor. It's a good metaphor because it's that, you know, there's no ball, you know, like, it's not there. And it's kind of like just thinking about some certain food that we like, or some certain thing that's going to be very exciting. Oh, I can't wait to see this movie. I can't wait till such and such happens. I'm going to go on this trip. And then what happens with me is I get there, and it's nothing like what I expected. And there's sometimes some sort of sukha-vedana, some happiness that I'm getting out of the moment, but there's always sometimes a pervasive sense of, oh, this is great, but if it was just a little bit sweeter, that would have been good. Or if there was just, God, if they had just done this instead of that, it would have been so much better. And so I think it's you know, the trick that I've tried to realize is, like, you know, sometimes many hours later I can realize, I guess he didn't really throw the ball, and it can be hours later that it's just like, what was I so angry about? What was that about? And so the trick, I think, for me with realizing discontent is just trying to dwell in sort of, I would say, non-reactivity to that mirage of you know, creating a self around the identities that we create around ourselves. I'm this way, I'm that way, and, you know, I am angry is an easy one, or I'm happy. You know, it's just, instead of just happiness is happening right now, and so. I've definitely don't have a I don't have a great knack for this, capital I. But I can see that the inspiration, the practice, is just when sometimes it's either a little bit sooner, or just even the fact that it happens, that there's a recognition that there's this mirage of discontent that I've blanketed over an experience. And I can recognize maybe that's just not true. Maybe that's not real. And so it's been really helpful sometimes when this can happen very soon, of course, and you know, just the story is not bought into, and something, you know, I should be this way. So, well, is that really true? Is that really how it is? Or just this understanding that the belief in all of these stories isn't going to be a skillful way for me to really find true happiness or seek what is content. And the more I see it is really that content is just the ability to be able to be with discontent longer and longer and see it more clearly. Because it's just so easy to be deluded by so many things that the mind creates, ideas of self, and that there's a way out of suffering through getting what we want, getting our likes met, and avoiding our dislikes, and so it sounds so easy, but just as a monk of just a few years, I'm just starting to get a little bit better at trying to catch the mind a step earlier, before it just buys into so many things, and it's not in any grandiose way or level, but it's just enough to give that inspiration to say, okay, wow, there's a way out of this kind of just continuing on with just a scowling and complaining and having a difficult experience. Something just as simple as even reversing the idea of, hearing somebody speak in a certain way that just is disconcerting, which is often like, just a reflection of myself speaking the same way. But just to say, like, well, what is it that they do that really pleases me and that's kind and good and generous? And immediately the perception can change and there can be this content from that experience. So, just kind of, for me, it's been a bit of a basic coming back to just pausing and trying to work out just a way to see that what I'm, sort of the ball that I'm running after, like a kind of a this happy-go-lucky golden retriever, isn't really... Either it hasn't been thrown or it's just not going to give me much happiness. And to try to come back to the present moment and see how I'm causing myself suffering. These are some words of reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. So I was actually pretty successful at not thinking about what I was going to say. Just trusting in the Dhamma. Fill in the blank, because that's kind of what my mind is doing right now. It's not really providing anything. Something that's been coming kind of coming back to me over and over again was the during the 2-week retreat that I was recently on. I kept seeing a lot of wildlife in the forest, and of course, it's not that unusual to see wildlife in the forest, but I just was noticing them more because I was spending so much time very quietly walking back and forth on my walking path. And I just saw a lot of blue jays, and there's these blue jays that we have here pretty much all the time. I guess they're called scrub jays. And they have kind of like a blue body and a blue head and kind of a white streak over their eyes. And we actually had some born in the vine over here next to the deck last year. They're very much a part of the kind of local scene. And while I was on retreat, there were these other kind of scrub jays that came along. and they have a blue body, but their head is almost completely black, and they have a bit of a ruff that looks like a mohawk. So these kind of like, you know, and they were kind of like a biker gang. You know, they kind of came in, and they've got this real kind of gruff, surly kind of call, you know, kind of grouchy sounding, bitter, demanding. And whereas the ones that sort of live here all the time are more, sort of sleek, kind of almost chirpy, but annoying, but not as annoying as these, biker gang blue jays were. And they were, I guess there was some sort of like annual, kind of scheduled, like territorial battle that has to happen. You know, the biker gang came in and they were up in the treetops and kind of, you know, bellowing at each other, and the other ones would come and chirp at them, and they'd fly to a different part of the forest and they'd bellow and chirp for a while. They're kind of flying all around doing this pretty much starting at about 4 o'clock in the morning and going on until pretty late at night. And I was just amazed by how much energy they're putting into this this battle. I keep my water pot. I have a water pot to wash the feet at the kuti. I always keep it full, and it was really dry this year. Lots of thirsty animals, and the black-headed jays would come down and drink out of the water pot and go get back to work. You know, yelling at the other jays. And every once in a while, one of the other jays would, you know, one of the white eyebrow jays would come down and get some water and, you know, back to it again. And it seems so kind of, I mean, I'm just putting the water out, but it seems so futile what they were doing, you know, out there in the trees yelling at each other like that. And eventually the black-headed jays, I guess they lost, I suppose. You know, they packed it up, they left. And between like battles of the jays, every once in a while a squirrel would come down and drink out of that water pot. And once a day or so, there's a pair of deer that were kind of like my kuti's, their neighborhood, they're part of their territory. They would come through and they'd come up the hill and they'd like see the water pot and they'd sort of speed up a little bit. It's a mother and her baby buck, and they'd both stick their heads in there. And this little water pot about the size of a coffee can, and just drain it. And then they'd knock it down the hill. Out of frustration, you know, because it was empty. So I'd fill it back up again and and then there were these bees and wasps, sort of late season bees, and there's, you know, apparently just had some tremendous use for water. They were come and they drink out of the little faucet. There'd be a little drip on the faucet. They drink that and they hang around the pot all day long drinking. They drink a little bit and fly away and come back again, I guess. I mean, I can't really tell who's who, but it just seems like there's always a swarm of these wasps drinking at my... And I got so used to them doing it that if they started bothering me, I know it was because the water pot was empty. The deer would come and kick the water pot down the hill, and then I knew, okay, it's empty, because the bees would come on my walking path and start landing on me and drinking my sweat. So I'd go and fill the water pot for them. And I knew that whenever they were sort of bugging me anywhere else in the monastery, all I had to do was just give them some water, and they would leave me alone. Thirsty bees. So, of course, while I was meditating and doing my walking meditation and seeing all this kind of activity, all these animals, and being in like kind of a front row seat because I had the water pot and everybody seemed interested in that. Yeah, it's a harsh reality, the animal realm. It's not easy. The deer are really hungry this time of year. I guess squirrels seem like they're pretty hungry too. And you know, if you're a blue jay, you have to kind of defend your territory. There's no easy life out there unless you're a golden retriever, I suppose. I guess it's kind of the same as it is for humans. And it depends on where you're born and your circumstances and whatnot. And most of the wildlife seem to have a pretty rough, paycheck to paycheck, but it's not, more like, you know, it's kind of scraping by, just barely making it pretty much all the time. No real prosperity. And seeing that constantly would remind me how really fortunate it is to be, you know, able to reflect, able to think about what's happening, able to see the suffering of others and sort of sympathize and refill the water pot for them, and have this opportunity to hear the Dhamma, which the more that you reflect on it, the more that you use it as a framework or a reference with which to consider what it is that you're seeing or hearing or thinking about, and put it in that context and look at it from that angle, the more it reveals, the more profound it is, and the more it sort of leads onward and leads inward and continues in the direction of showing you more and more about how the world really works.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So last year, I'm really excited because I made it through the Namatasa right now. Last year, I really had to make it through that. I like totally forgot it. Which is very interesting. It was also interesting sitting here and watching my poor heart's reaction and response every time Ajahn Pasana was about to call a name. Because from the get-go, I was like, wow, it'd be so great just to... I had so much... it was a combination of mudita and envy of Tanti Dipanya. Because it was like, the idea was like, wow, you know, if I could just go first, the rest of the night I could just sit here and enjoy everybody else's talk. And every time there was like this anticipation. Because there was a really good chance that, my name would be called. And then it didn't happen, and then it was disappointment. And then it was like, there was a slight shift, and then I was like, a genuine sense of mudita for the people whose names did get called, because then they could just, they were good, you know, for the rest of the evening. And then it occurred to me, because last year after I gave the talk, I sat down, and then I'm spinning out about like what I said. You know what I mean? Sort of. And then I was like, well, then to hell with it, you know? I might as well just chill out, because no matter what happens, my mind's going to find some way to suffer. In 2001, I spent about 4 or 5 weeks at Wat Nanashat, and the guest monk at that time was a monk named Tanyadiko, and myself, a guy from Chicago named Scott, and an Irishman named Patty. Sounds like a setup for a joke. Had to go to Laos to allow us to do our visa, to renew our visa. And I guess Ajahn Yatiko had recommended to Patty that we go by this monastery in the northeast, also farther up, that was close to Nong Khai, with the border town by where you go to Laos to get your visa. Because there was an old English monk who was apparently really wise and worth visiting. And in my own practice, and you know, I'm shortly out of college. I'm like a year out of college at that point. Spent some time working, and then I was traveling. But nonetheless, I'd come to the point where I was like, "Look, no one could tell me anything. This is so hard, and I just have to go through this alone." And that's it. And then, went to Laos, went to this monastery, because I was like, why not? What do I have to lose? You know? And sure enough, the English monk ended up being Ajahn Panyavado, and he was indeed, the wisest person I'd ever met. I'd never met anyone like that in my life. He was the first person I ever met who seemed like he knew what was going on. No one, not my folks, not my teachers, no one I'd ever met seemed like they knew what was happening. And I mean, what's happening on like an existential level? What are we? Why are we? What is this? And the solace that provided. And so then I proceeded to just a barrage, every question I ever had, you know, guidance on everything. It was my diet. I came down, I was like, you know, over the span of the time that I was there, should I eat this? And after a while, I sort of, turned the camera back on me, and for the time that I spent there with him, there was a response that I got to a lot of my questions after a while was, try it. You know, should I do the asubha practice? Should I fast? Should I do the sitter's practice? Should I do metta? Try it. You know, see what happens. He would talk about, like, if it works, it's good. Point blank. If it helps, it's good. If it leads to the cessation of suffering, it's good. You should do it if it leads to the cessation of suffering. If it doesn't, maybe not. It's very empowering. And that the value of experience, personal experience, to allay doubt. Ajahn Chah pointed to that as well, that the value of personal experience. And no one can tell you. I hear other people ask similar questions, and I myself still ask Ajahn Pasno similar questions. Want him to do it for me, want him to tell me, but no one can take away my doubt except for experience. I wish it was otherwise. And so in the Buddha's medicine cabinet, there's a lot of different medicines, and some of them, the whole thing, one man's poison is another man's medicine. The asubha practice, for example, ain't for everybody. For some people, it's very good. and for some people it's very bad. I remember Ajahn Panya talking about a woman at Bontad who was doing it, really going for it, and she was a hate character, and it was really not helpful for her, and he turned her on to the metta bhavana. And it's sort of a blessing and the curse, I think, of the Dhamma. It's one, I mean, you have to do it yourself. It's not one prescription for everybody. And no one, you know, the teacher can give suggestions, but you have to put it to work. And if it works, it's good. Another thing that he, Ajahn Panya talked about a couple times was, and I'm sure this shows up in the sutta, I've seen it in the suttas, but I'm not a sutta expert, I can't tell you where. Or even if it was a variation on something in the suttas, but anyway, it resonated, and it continues to, is that the Dhamma is like a snake. If you grab it by the head, you're going to be okay. But if you grab it by the tail, it's going to bite you. Same thing with a blade of grass. You got to grab it the right way, it'll cut you. Didn't make sense. How on earth could the Dhamma be like a snake? But, you know, it just makes sense more and more and more as the years go by, seeing how I grasp the Dhamma and the importance of grasping the Dhamma with the Dhamma, because I have suffered so much over my practice. I'm sure I'm not the only one. But just, you know, judging and wanting and hating and worrying, just on and on, instead of gratitude, perhaps, you know, to the Dhamma, to the Buddha, to the Sangha. So many better ways of holding it. Letting go, maybe. In the Vinaya, suffering about the Vinaya, holding the Vinaya super duper tight. Instead of finding that balance, holding the Dhamma with the Dhamma, relating to the Dhamma skillfully. Because I think in the beginning it was like, oh, I just got to do it.
A lot of themes floating around and coming to me in my whole life here. I think, yeah, spiritual friends, Kalyana Mitta, has been a huge part. In the practice of Dhamma, I guess you try to use everything as a mirror. The rules, the lifestyle, the regularity, the daily schedule. And relationships with people can be turbulent, but highly has a lot of depth to it. It's also because of, and in a way, because of that turbulence, it's maybe it gives you a lot of gain on your feedback. But they can provide a lot of encouragement. And yeah, I guess it's probably one of my biggest refuges myself, is fellow samanas, people trying to do what I've been trying to do. So many people I met in the world and had a lot of different kinds of friends, a lot of different people and places, but nobody seemed really, nobody got it. Nobody really understood what was going on, but not even that, a lot of people weren't even trying to figure out what was going on, which was a little disconcerting. But coming here and still not understanding and still not getting it, but being in a place where people are genuinely trying to be good people and to find peace and to understand. It was it felt like a long journey for me to find some place like this, but I'm really happy to be here. And even the darkest moments, they aren't as dark, because I do feel that not only are there options, the teachings give us plenty of options, tactics and methods and different approaches and things we can take, but also, I mean, these things are being tried in and around us by other people. So there's a wealth of experience and sincere attempts. You do need to try for yourself. Sometimes you don't even know what to try. And to be able to have that resource, those mirrors and those teachers all around us, it's something that I find myself being thankful for every day. All for that reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I thought I'd talk about the four elements tonight. But before you go to sleep, give me a chance to justify it. Most people hear the four elements and they say, oh, great, boring. But I've actually really found them great food for Dhamma reflection and really profound teaching, interesting teaching. Practical as well, useful. I don't have the Pali for the four elements memorized. Usually they're translated into English as earth, the earth element, the fire element, water element, and sometimes, which annoys me quite a bit, the fourth one's translated as the air element, but I highly suggest it it should be translated as the wind element as opposed to air. Does anyone know the Pali? Vayu is wind.
Moving.
What about the other three?
Apo, Pachavi, and Tejo.
Tejo.
Water, earth, fire.
And so the first element, earth, well, another way to think of these elements would be solidity, liquidity, temperature, and energy. So the earth element could be translated as, useful words would be solidity, mass, things like weight, perhaps. Then you've got the fire element, temperature, heat, but temperature is relative, so even if something is cold, there's still fire element. It's just and the nighttime for a Martian would be quite warm, or quite a bit colder than nighttime for us here on Earth, temperature wise. But the it's just relative, and then the water element, liquidity or cohesion, malleability, perhaps mixability. I don't know if that's a word, but then the wind element, energy, motion, pressure. Vibration, and these are the four elements, and so you've got the teaching of the five aggregates, and there's form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, and the first one is form, and so that's what form is. It's these four elements. And then, of course, the other four of the five khandhas are mental phenomena, feeling, perception, mental fabrication, and consciousness. Which is interesting because then, if you take the teaching on the six senses, instead of the small bit being form, it's kind of the opposite. You've got the six senses. So you've got the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. And those are all form, rupa, and then the last is the six senses, the mind. So it's just the small bit is the mental bit for the six sense bases. It's interesting. Sometimes I wonder if perhaps the five khandhas are more aimed towards people who like to reflect on the mental aspect of experience, and the six sense bases teaching is more for people who like to investigate form. I don't know. But so with the six senses, so you've got sights, or you've got the eye, and this is I think many people they relate to form visually, the four elements in a visual way, because it's just such a big part of our world, the sight, scientifically we know that it's light particles bouncing off materiality, and then it goes to our eye. And so, and it's interesting, in Tibetan Buddhism, the way they represent rupa is a mirror, because a mirror, it only reflects form. So it's kind of interesting. And then you've got sound. We know that it's vibration waves. That hit the eardrum, and they vibrate the eardrum, and there's this vibration, this movement, which creates a hearing sound. And then you've got the nose and smells, this is an interesting one. Whenever we smell something, it's actually fine, microscopic particles sometimes not microscopic, but very small particles of whatever that material is that we smell. So, you know, remember that next time you go into the restroom and it smells bad. There's an addressing a Subha contemplation. Or when you go into the kitchen, you know, it's just a piece of tofu in your nose. Taste, you know, obviously it's you have to put physical form onto your tongue, and then there's taste. You know. And the most obvious one, touch. It's of course we contact the different contact form, and there's feeling, and actually I think the most interesting way to really contemplate form is out of the four elements is through the touch, through that sense of touch. And for myself, by far the most interesting one for me is the wind element. And so what I was kind of talking about with the six senses, those are mainly, you know, we have those senses in our body, but that's all dependent on interaction with things that are external for the most part. Although with touch, you can always, you can always feel the body, even if you're not touching something externally. So wind is a really interesting one to reflect on. And I think when people think of the four elements, they think in a very Western way, at least for Westerners, of like the elemental chart, and you think of, like, elements. But yeah, I think there's a lot more to them. You know, for example, just different reflections like gravity. You know, which of the four elements is gravity? You know, it's essentially it's you could say it's a mixture, but it's mainly the wind element. It's that pulling, or you could think, well, what is it what aspect of the body, which of the four elements is that which resists gravity? You know, when we're walking around, we're always, you know, there's a resistance to gravity. We're always having to do something to prevent us from just, like, falling down on the ground. And that's, you know, that's, so that's the wind element. That's the energy that holds the body up, the tension of the muscles, or the, you know, that energy. And it's the wind element is also, it seems to me, like the element that's, you also use it to sort of discern the other elements. For example, like with weight, you know, to determine how something weighs. I mean, it's you pick something up, you know, and you know how much it weighs in a relative sense because of how much wind element you have to exert to hold it up. You know, lifting up a clock, there's only so much pressure or energy that needs to be expended to hold it up. But if you had to lift up a bowling ball, you know, it'd take a bit more of the wind element, a bit more energy. And it's like the with the breath, you could also say that it's the wind element that actually, you know, causes the air to go in and out of the lungs. It's not actually the air that comes in and out of the lungs. It's the wind element. It's the energy that pulls the air in and out of the body. That's the wind element. You know, when you breathe in, there's a energy that has to be expended to bring in the air, and same with, you know, breathing out. So the earth element, solidity, mass, I guess. And then it's pretty straightforward and obvious. And fire element, temperature, it's pretty obvious you can. I think it's useful to recognize that the four elements are not just things that are external, but they're actually like they're a big part of our just experience of the body when we're sitting here meditating. It's the sense of touch, the heat of the or the temperature of the body, and the energy and the various aspects. That's all that's coming to mind right now, so whether I justify talking about the four elements, I don't know, but I'll leave it at that for now. So.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's nice hearing all the talks tonight. This brings up a lot of joy. For myself, I've been reflecting on perception quite a bit in recent times. So this is my 10th punsa, 10th vasa, so finishing that up. And it's partly why just reflecting on how I perceive myself or how others perceive me or how people perceive each other in general. And so got an email from my friend Jivako in Australia, and it's, how does it feel to be an Ajahn? Or some people, like at the beginning of the punsa, like, okay, you're an Ajahn now. And some people, no, it's at the end of punsa. So some people congratulated me, like, congratulations, at the beginning of punsa. And then my favorite was Tanti Dipunyos handed me a letter of congratulation with a chocolate bar in it. Two months into punsa, it's kind of in the middle. So it wasn't at the beginning or the end. It's like, congratulations, you're an Ajahn now. It's like 2 months into punsa. Kind of random time. Also thinking about this quite a bit because I was looking after a branch monastery of Wat Nanachat for a couple of years, Wat Pujumgong, and traditionally it's a place where it's had people looking after it, but they're not really called abbots. It's more like a sangha office for Wat Nanachat. But then as I'm there, One of the first pieces of advice Longpo gave me was, don't think of yourself as an abbot. And I think I can make the claim that I followed that advice really well. But it's interesting with perception and other people's perceptions. And you have lay people coming and it's like, oh, congratulations, you're an abbot now. And or some people coming and saying like, oh, I'm sorry, you're an abbot. I think even Paul Breiter wrote in his new book, what's it called? The One Monk, Many Masters. Something like, just like writes about me in his new book, because he met my parents in Thailand and we were driving around together. And him and my dad got on well. They're both kind of cynical types. They bonded. They bonded. So he writes that, I met this monk's parents, and it turns out he's the abbot of this branch monastery. He's but a boy. So, was showing me this. Hey, I think he's talking about you. Oh, wow, he is. But so it's kind of, yeah, interesting with perception. Like in the Thai monks, because I spent my 7th punsa at Wat Pa Pong, and then I was at Pujumgam for my 8th and 9th punsas. And like the Thai monks coming up to me, like, oh, it's like, Sedang Kwam Yin Di, and Jia Wat Lao. It's like, oh, congratulations, you're an abbot. And they're just kind of joking around with me. And monks that were also my same number of punsas, there's a whole slew of them at Wat Pa Pong as kind of friends with. Or like, even Ajahn Kevali was like announcing me as like the abbot. It's kind of embarrassing sometimes, but what also like it's kind of impolite also to say like, you know, don't call me that. Or, so it's kind of just watching internally, like keeping my own perception of myself kind of stable, like thinking of it, well, you know, it's a Sangha office, it's like being the guest monk or something. And so that kind of now it seems kind of impolite if somebody called me Ajahn in the beginning of Pansa, like, don't call me that. You know, but it's just looking internally, like, you know, not getting puffed up about it, or like, I'm an Ajahn. You know, certainly internally I don't feel any different, but it has brought up like thinking, this is kind of when I was 5 punsas also, these kind of, you know, every 5 years sort of thinking back, like, has there been positive changes? And sometimes when I think back to when I was an Anagarika and a novice, I get really embarrassed and think like, wow, you know, there has been some changes, and don't get irritated as much or as easily about things I used to. I think I'm easier to get along with now than I was back then, and sometimes I'm surprised people put up with me. And it's a lot of gratitude to the community. But it's tying in with the theme of perception, and also a story that came to mind when Tanke Mako was giving his talk about animals was an experience I had at Pujumgam when it was 2 hot seasons ago, so it was really, really hot, and Pujumgam is, there's not many trees, the trees that are there are very small, and it's got these rocks which absorb heat during the day and then release it at night, so it's hot all the time, and you're just sweating day and night. So it was a hot season, and I was there by myself for a period, and so I was, what I would do is I would do walking meditation. I was staying in a kuti down below, and the sauna is kind of near this kuti, and there's a stove outside of the sauna, and I was doing walking meditation, and I would take my angsa and I would put it in a bucket of water and then put it on, and in 15 minutes it would be dry, and then I just dunk it back in the bucket of water again, so I'm always have some sort of evaporative cooling happening around me, and is just kind of doing walking meditation through the day. And at one point, it's also, it can be kind of eerie and almost too quiet at this place, and there's just nobody around, no other monks there, and I was doing walking meditation, and it's just, even the insects are quiet because it's so hot, and no wind, and I looked over and there was this kind of emaciated starving dog standing near my walking meditation path staring at me, and it was just me and that kind of, it was, had some sort of disease, I think, because it was just skin and bones. And that this dog was kind of like moving very slowly and kind of looking up at me with like deep inset glazed over languid eyes kind of staring at me. And then it would kind of go away, and then the next day it would kind of come back, and it'd be even more emaciated looking, and I was thinking, you know, this dog's going to die any day now. And it would lay down then at my kuti, and as it laid down, these ants would come and swarm all over it, and then it would get up and move to another place, and then the ants would kind of go to it and swarm all over it again. And then I decided, oh, I'm going to give it some water. And so I gave it some water, and it kind of looked up at me and then drank from the water. And then afterwards I looked at the water, and there was kind of like pink bits of flesh and whatever floating in the water. So this dog was really kind of falling apart. And then I was wondering where it must be living around here. So I saw that it was actually living in the sauna stove, because that's the only place the ants wouldn't go. It wouldn't go in the ashes, so it would go and kind of cover itself in the charcoal. And then the next day I sort of didn't see it, and then a slight wind came up, and this certainly I smelled, oh, something died. That dog must have died. And so I knew it was living in the sauna stove, so I went over, and sure enough, it was not in the stove, but nearby. It had kind of crawled out and then just fell over dead. It had been dead for a couple of days. And so, it was rotting, and so I thought, I got to take it away from here because it smells really awful. So, yeah, I got a shovel and wheelbarrow, and it was just strange being there completely alone with this dog is like my only friend, like I died. So I picked it up with the shovel, and it kind of like started falling apart, and it was really disgusting. And then I kind of was able to shovel it into the wheelbarrow and plop it off into some other area where the wind wouldn't bring the smell of death into my kuti. But I'm just thinking, you know, as that dog was kind of looking up at me, at my kuti, with its, you know, it wasn't thinking like you're an abbot or you're an ajahn. It's just like, you're that nice guy who gave me water before I died. So I'll leave that for your reflections.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Nervousness feels like this. It's pretty interesting. I was reflecting about just being here is not what I expected. I have this distinct memory of being on retreat at Tathagata Meditation Center in San Jose, enjoying peaceful meditation. This one sit in particular, walking away from that, and doing some walking meditation, feeling great, and looking up at the starry sky, and just like, oh yeah, this is it. I want to become a monk, or you know, I want to live in a monastery. I want to keep pursuing this. Kind of romantic, kind of. Fantasy. I mean, might as well have been a shooting star or something. But 6 months later, come to Abhayagiri, and not what I expected. Just starting to get the feel of what a monastery looks like, how to make this a lifestyle, rather, and seeing the distinction between incorporating the practice in your life and retreat. Seeing how this is a more holistic way of looking at the path, the communication, the work. The interaction, the kind of more independence, the responsibility, you making your own decisions during the day rather than having set schedules and so forth. It's a different story. So, I kind of have mixed feelings about Ajahn Chah. It's just utmost respect and reverence for this kind of creating this kind of structure within a monastery of a good amount of work, and especially for an Anagarika, as well as the interaction combined with the formal. But also this kind of frustration. It's very challenging, very difficult. So, so all that being said, one of the things that I've learned from retreat practice and enjoy carrying that into this lifestyle is being with the breath, but more in particular, bringing good qualities into relating with the breath or being with the breath. So something that's been coming up recently is just this word, stay. Staying, just stay. So you have this, I have this, the awareness of the object of the breath. That seems like two kind of, the two ends of it, the two extremes. You got the awareness that which knows, and then the object, the other, what you're with, the other side of the coin, if you will. And what I'm finding as time goes by is that what's really important is what's in between the two. The attitude, the qualities of mind, the mind states, how the awareness is taking up the object, how it's being with it, how it's working with it. This is what I'm seeing is giving good results, pleasant results, peaceful results. And just kind of coming back to this, it's not what I thought. right here, this talk right now, it's not what I thought. Being at this monastery is not what I thought. Awareness is not what I think. So I'll offer that for reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. There's a lot of places in the canon where the Buddha talks about various wholesome qualities, positive qualities that he encourages us to develop. And just naturally, some of these qualities tend to be spoken about more often than others. And one that's mentioned a bit less often is in the Pali, it's bahusutta. Literally means much learning or very learned. And when the Buddha defines this, he speaks about someone who's had learned a lot, remembers what they've learned, accumulates a massive learning about those dhammas which are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Recites them, examines them mentally, and penetrates through to their meaning. And this is something which, and particularly in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha mentions this quality over and over and over again as something very praiseworthy, very beneficial. So I thought, since this is something which I found useful in my own practice, I might talk a little bit about some of the benefits I see in developing an understanding of the content of the suttas. And I can't claim to have any deep insight into the profundity of it, but I can say a bit about what just having this information in one's mind can have an effect on. So, I mean, one thing which I really noticed is that, and the Buddha tends to draw a really hard line in the suttas about what is helpful and what is not helpful, like what is beneficial and what is harmful. And so what I find is that having this information in one's mind, when a harmful mind state arises or when a negative mind state arises, there's much less opportunity for self-deceit. It's like when you've just been reading something in the suttas and the Buddha makes it really clear, like in the Savasava Sutta, he mentions that a sensual thought is not to be tolerated, it's to be abandoned, removed, destroyed, completely annihilated. That's pretty strong language. So then if one finds that one is having some kind of sensual thought arising, then one might remember having read that, and then the response is immediate. It's like, what did the Buddha say? He said, don't tolerate this. Abandon it, remove it, destroy it, annihilate it. And the study says the same for like thoughts of cruelty, thoughts of ill will. Any kind of unwholesome thought, this is something that's not to be tolerated. And the Buddha speaks about it somewhat differently in different places. Like, for example, in the Satipatthana Sutta, which many people are very familiar with, when the Buddha speaks about like seeing the states of the mind, then he puts it in much much softer terms, he simply speaks about knowing the mind with desire is the mind with desire. The mind free of desire is the mind free of desire. The mind with hate is the mind with hate. The mind free of hate is the mind free of hate. And so on. And if one simply takes that set on its own merits, then you get kind of like knowing states of the mind, which is okay. But when that sutta is taken in the context of the broader basis of what the Buddha taught, then it becomes clear that that's the first step in a process which is not terribly fleshed out in that particular sutta, but which he goes into far more detail in other places. So it's like you're looking at your mind and you see there's hate in my mind. Well, it doesn't stop there. It's like then, well, what do we do with that hate? We abandon it. We remove it. We destroy it. We completely annihilate it. It's not something to be tolerated. It's not something to be put up with. So it's like the same in reading through the suttas. There are many things which over and over again the Buddha states in various ways, in various places. And that's always floating in the back of one's mind. There's always this kind of little running voice of the Buddha saying, what's useful, what's not useful. And just plugging a little bit into the suttas every day. It's like it keeps that voice going. And over time it builds up. Just reading a few minutes a day, it doesn't take long before one can go through a whole set of suttas very quickly. And there's some other enormous substantial benefits that come from this. The thing is that particularly in this place and time, we're exposed to a wide variety of different teachings from a wide variety of different sources. Of course, there's Theravada and Mahayana and Vajrayana, and then even within Theravada, there's a wide variety of different teaching styles and approaches coming from various teachers and various states of being. So it can be a bit confusing to sort through all that and come to what's really, really valuable. And the Buddha gives us a set of tools for working with exactly that kind of problem. And it's mentioned again in several places in the suttas as the four great standards, which is a bit of a misnomer because it's basically one standard put in four slightly different circumstances. But basically the standard is that when somebody comes to you and tells you what their opinion of the teaching is, then without either rejecting or approving of it, one instead compares it to what's been handed down in the suttas, what's been handed down in the Vinaya. And then from that one can know whether or not this is the Dhamma or not. If it lines up with what's in the Pali Canon, then it's Dhamma. If it doesn't, then it isn't. And this is an incredibly simple and really powerful tool, but it does depend on one having some basis of knowledge in the suttas. But with that basis, it's the underlying pattern of the Buddha's teaching begins to become quite clear. There's a certain distinct flavor to the suttas which is not often present in other sources. And just from that recognition can start to arise a deep level of confidence. It's very difficult to conceive of the suttas as having come from anyone other than a completely enlightened Buddha. And at first glance that might not be apparent, but read through a few dozen suttas and it all starts to fit together. Like there's just no possible way it could come from any other source. like from this what we get is a deeply rooted confidence in the Buddha, deeply rooted confidence in the Dhamma, a capacity to filter the information we receive, to filter the teachings that we come across. And perhaps most importantly, what we gain is a set of tools for investigating the states of our own mind, a set of tools for working with the mind states that arise, for discarding that which is obstructive to the path, and for developing that which is helpful. So I'll leave that for your reflection this evening.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami.
So a lot of different thoughts have been kind of coursing through my mind tonight, listening to other people talk, and I think one theme that seems to be recurrent over the years that comes up a lot for me is just I guess it's around perception. And I was reflecting back to back in 2002 when Mary Curran, the one who owned Casa Serena, and she was dying, and her sister and I were her caretakers. But at that point, actually, this was even before then, this was still when she was in the hospital, and I had stopped coming back to Redwood Valley because I'd been going every day, and she'd gone through some really heavy ups and downs and had gone through I think it was at least once, maybe more than once, where it actually seemed like she might not make it through her stay at the hospital. She might actually die in the hospital. And so we started staying. Somebody always was with her every night in the room. And if you've ever stayed in a hospital, I'm not sure what it's like to stay as a patient, because I've been very blessed with good health, but to stay there and spend a lot of time in a hospital just as a friend or supporter, it's a very intense environment, and it's very exhausting. And I can remember going out and walking and thinking, how can everybody, the world is still going on, how can everybody, they're just going on as if this isn't happening, as if Mary isn't in the hospital dying, possibly, or and then I just recently that similar thing, it was held a bit differently, the texture was a bit different, but I was recently at my parents' house because my parents are aging and my mom's health isn't good, and it's a lot more peaceful being at my parents' house than it was being in the hospital. But my mom can't do a whole lot of things, so she sits on the couch a lot and doesn't have, it's hard for her to get up to go to the toilet. But she has a television on a lot. And on Sunday, it was the, as many know, it was the fourth game in the World Series. And I'm not much of a sports fan, but my dad was really keen on watching this, and so at one point that was on the television, and it must have been, they were kind of showing scenes of the audience, and, or the people, the spectators, and it must have been supporters for Detroit, I think was the other team, and these, the looks on their faces, because it was pretty clear that the giants were probably going to take it. And the looks on their faces, it was kind of like, these are people, this is a game. It's a sport. And they look so devastated. And I thought, it's so ironic because people on the East Coast were about to face the devastation of a hurricane, probably one of the worst hurricanes that has ever hit the East Coast in our lifetime. And they were facing this uncertainty of, were they going to have, if they had left, if they didn't leave, were they going to live through it? Or if they left, what would they have to come back to? When were they going to be able to come back? What about the work they had piling up on their desk that they couldn't get to? What about, you know, all the plans that they had? And it's just this, it's very humbling to me how we try to bring these things into our awareness and how they keep slipping out of our grasp and we forget. And then something comes and hits us over the head again and we remember. Kind of what's important, how do we hold it? How do we stay with that uncertainty? How do we remind ourselves about that uncertainty or that that constant place where we can't know, we can't predict what events are going to happen, what's going to be the next thing to grab our attention? And sometimes I feel like I look and I see, and I found myself saying this to people, just how I see this monastery as becoming, it's maturing. I you know, having been here from the beginning, seeing it grow, and just what joy that brings to my heart to see the size of it, the way it's maturing and stuff. And then I had this insight one day recently, that is what's happening, but you still can't kind of find the words for this, still can't really relax into that, maybe, I guess is the way, and just find some sense of ease in that, because it really is all about, anything can change, and really where we have to put our awareness, our confidence is in just that awareness that comes from within, and being able to be present. I'm not expressing this very well, but just that ability to not get locked into an idea of how things are, to more bring to mind as much as possible, always, in every moment, that it is constantly changing, and most of the time it's changing in ways that are too subtle for us to really take in, but where we can stand is in that awareness and our trust in the Dhamma, and we can still find joy in the other things that are around us that might maybe give us inspiration in times when we're not so inspired, when it's gone flat. But I don't know, there's something, it seems so so simple and so obvious, and yet it's really hard to grasp and to hold that kind of that sense of this it's all changing, it's all and and maybe that's not, I mean, that's just the way it is. It's not bad, it's not good. And just remember to be present. And yeah, anyway, I'm going to stop there.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang namang sanghang namassami. The mind has kind of been kind of trying to find a suitable topic to talk about, and kind of been trying to try to pull it back and keep it from wandering, but it's kind of brought up quite a few different reflections, but yeah, I feel like what I really want to say, though, just for these few minutes, yeah, it's just to express appreciation for the whole community. I don't think I knew when I first heard about this place, or when I first came here, really what it would be like here, what the community would be like, what the structure would be like, and yeah, it's so much goes so much deeper than I would have imagined. Just the training just seems to be aimed at really exploring a very, very deep level of our minds, and the suffering that we all create, and yeah, I found for myself, of course, I'm sure we're all motivated to come here because of suffering. It's really a great motivation to change, to seek some way out. And I know for myself, I tried many, many different things in lay life, and all of the usual kind of avenues that one would look for happiness, and just kind of wandering aimlessly, really, for a long time, just making the same mistakes over and over again, and experiencing the same suffering over and over again, and just being totally caught in that. And I guess we all just, whether monastic or lay, we all come to a point, I think, where just that suffering is finally come to be motivated enough to change our lifestyles, and whether we actually come and ordain as a monastic, or whether it's just maybe kind of changing our lifestyle a little bit and coming to visit the monastery regularly and having a daily meditation practice. It's really a big step either way. Really been finding that everything really about the way that life is structured here, the community aspects, kind of the routine with work and kind of daily tasks and responsibilities, is just it's a great tool for training the mind, because it's so great at bringing up defilements. I found for myself just the past year and a half, a lot of it has been incredibly difficult, but it's been just incredibly wholesome though too. Yeah, it really seems the whether it's working and interacting with just this the community with just a vast array of different people, different backgrounds and personalities, and then also interacting with the schedule, which is kind of constantly challenging our likes and dislikes, what we want to do. Finding out for myself that's really some of the biggest causes of suffering for myself here, and I'm sure others as well, is just just holding on to that, our preferences, our likes and dislikes, wanting to do what we like, not wanting to do what we don't like, wanting to be around people that we like, not wanting to be around people that we don't like, and being in situations that we like, that is just it's kind of very simple attachment, and it would seem that maybe one could maybe let go of it if one could see it, but it's just so incredibly strong and deeply ingrained. So I feel that however long it takes, I feel that this lifestyle is really really aimed at challenging those kind of root defilements. Really challenging our views, and eventually leading to the ability to see through these things, let go of them, and come to realize peace. So I'll offer that for reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddha Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So I've deeply enjoyed hearing everyone's talks tonight. really everyone is then sharing with quite a lot of wisdom. I don't know how much I'm going to be able to add. I thought that I would at least say and recite one of my favorite suttas that keeps recurring again and again to me. It's in the third chapter, the Devaputta Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's the Buddha's verses to the Deva Subrahma. And as is usual in these, all the suttas in the Devaputta Samyutta, a Deva comes to the Buddha and then says something, and the Buddha responds. And so Subrahma comes to the Buddha and says, always frightened is this mind. The mind is always anxious about unarisen problems and about arisen ones as well. If there exists release from fear, being asked, please declare it to me. And the Buddha responds, not apart from enlightenment and austerity, not apart from restraint of all the senses, not apart from relinquishing all, do I see any safety for living beings. And that has a lot of impact for me. The Devas really have it in the cosmic scheme of things. The Devas have it really good, and yet Subrahma has enough wisdom to be still plagued by fear. There's a commentarial story that says half of his retinue of nymphs all died at once. But I mean, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I don't know. But something has really stirred this this being. And yeah, I mean, part of it is that I find myself that actually when I look at things overall, I have remarkably little suffering in my life, and yet still, I mean, the problem is that, well, there's always fear, because, you know, as long as there's clinging, well, then the better you have it, almost the more there is to worry about. And so Subrahma understands that, and the Buddha basically gives no quarter in his answer. He's saying exactly the way it is. And I guess part of the skill in relating to this is that, I mean, one can just take that in and have it bring up even more fear. But somehow I find it I find it fairly yeah, for whatever reason, I find it inspiring. Yeah, that has a lot to do with why I choose to live this life. And yeah, I'm just faith that that can be possible if you really did relinquish all, then there wouldn't be anything more to fear. So I think I will close with that.